stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Carolyn Burns, co-founder with her husband, Jim O'Neill, of the Rubicon Theater in Ventura, California, the very first professional theater ever to be in Ventura, California. Carolyn's story is interesting. Like many people who become actors, directors, producers, Carolyn discovered her desire to tell stories, to produce stories, to act in stories, to help other people find stories very, very, very young. It's a fascinating and interesting and charming story. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down.
The Lynn Show is about self-discovery, the discovery of self. How is it possible that we could need, any of us could need, to discover a self? Don't we have a self that we are living with day in and day out? Do we have to go looking somewhere else for this self? Of course not. This self is living inside of us, and yet, so many of us are not acquainted with our whole self. So many of us have aspects, abilities, tendencies, interests, talents, skills, dreams, possibilities that we don't know about, that we don't have access to, that we can't embrace, enjoy, demonstrate, offer to the world even. Even if this weren't a self-care need, and you know, as a therapist, I know, well, okay, this is the gospel according to Lynn. I believe, you don't have to agree with me, but I believe that our life is diminished by everything about us to which we don't have access. That if there is a talent, a skill, an instinct, an impulse, a wish, a desire, a possibility that lives within us, and we can't use it, get at it, experience it, embrace it, enjoy it, struggle with it, then our life is diminished. Our light is dimmed. And that not only costs us in our ability to enjoy our life, but it costs the world. Could you have had a dream that changed the world? I wonder if you were listening 2 weeks ago when I interviewed David Shepherd, who said he wanted to revolutionize the theater. This guy who, you know, was teaching English in India, didn't know exactly what he could do or would do with his life. He was 30 years old, and it occurred to him that he wanted to transform, revolutionize, that was his word, the theater. Imagine. And he did. So if David had been unable to embrace, to demonstrate, even to know that he was someone who had this idea, or if he knew this was someone who had this idea, but he didn't think he was someone who could do anything about it, the theater would not be revolutionized. We would not have improvisational theater, certainly not in the way we have it today. So this idea of self-discovery, of the recovery, self-recovery, is not only selfish. It's not only that your life will be better, that you will be happier, that you will feel complete, satisfied, excited. But the world will have access to what you have to offer. And our world needs everybody. As I don't have to tell you about that. That's not what the show is about. But if you read the newspapers, if you watch TV, if you go out in the street, if you talk to your friends, you know that our world needs every bit of help that it can get. So if you have an idea, a fantasy, a wish, a talent, an impulse that you're not giving to the world, you are diminished by it, and so are we. So The Lynn Show is about making this point. I'm a psychotherapist. I have a private practice. At the moment, my entire private practice, and for the last 10 or 15 years, has been exclusively on the telephone. So if you are interested in psychotherapy, if you're interested in psychotherapy on the go, which is the name of my article that I wrote about therapy on the phone, if you're interested in self-discovery, if you think there might be something inside of you that's dying to be exposed, that's dying to be understood, embraced, and used, you can talk to me about that. You can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynne. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You'll get another Lynn Show. The Lynn Show, thelynneshow.com. And on my website, you can find a link to email me. You can find the article, Psychotherapy on the Go. You can find a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can find out anything that you want to know about me. Just about everything is up there. And you could get me to come and talk to your group or organization, or you could talk to me, ask me a question. One of the other things that's up on my website are all of the shows that I ever did and all of the interviews that I've done. And I do an interview in every show, that is to say I air an interview in every show because they're all pre-recorded. And the interviews are all of people who make their living or their life with an art. I interview these people because when you listen to someone who has dedicated their life and or made a living with an art, you are listening to someone who is exactly who they are, at least in the area of their work, because this culture makes it so difficult, and you hear it over and over again in most of the interviews, the struggle, the obstacles that people have to endure, go through, overcome, to continue to infuse their life with their art. And so when you listen to them, you can hear it. You can hear that they are what we therapists call congruent. What you hear is what you get. This is who they are. And of course, I hope that when you listen to this, listen to someone speaking about their work, that if there's something inside of you that has been hidden, denied, depressed, that it may be jumping up and down inside of you saying, here I am, see me, find me, use me, know me, be me. And if that happens and you want to do something about that, you can, as I said, go up on the website and talk to me, although God knows I am not the only therapist in the universe, and you may know one closer by or something. By all means, go out and find them. Do something to discover and use yourself. So today, the interview I am airing is with Carol Lynn Burns. She, along with Jim O'Neill, whose interview you heard last week, if you were listening, founded the Rubicon Theater in Ventura, California, the very first professional theater in Ventura, California. And the Rubicon, the name, choosing the Rubicon, is of course instructive. Once you have set foot in the Rubicon, you cannot turn back. And you will hear Carolyn speak about some of the obstacles that they have faced, are facing. But they do seem to have committed for the long haul, and they are not turning back. And Carolyn's story is really adorable because she discovered what she wanted to do. She wanted to be a producer by the time she was four. This is a very, very delightful story told by a truly delightful, committed, alive, and passionate woman. So I'm not going to say another word here. Carol Lynn Burns. Okay, so I'm here with Carol Lynn Burns in the Rubicon lobby, and I'm explaining to Carolyn that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it's clear that you are making, perhaps have always made, your life with the art of theater.
Yes, I was a publicist for some time too, and I was a double major in theater and journalism in college, so it's always been in and around the art. For a lot of years, I was more on the administrative side, but in one side or the other.
Okay, all right. So I want to hear the story, and the question that I ask primarily is, do you remember in the very first time in your life when you thought that you would be interested in writing, acting? Are you also an actor?
I am.
Yeah,
yes,
right. That's what I thought, right. Yes. So that performance, stories, any of that, do you remember when that started for you?
I do. I think I've my very first memories, to me, seem like they are about theater or, you know, I think theater probably starts for many of us as the impulse to play as mm-hmm. children. Mm-hmm. And the games that my siblings and I all played as children were often around plays that we'd seen or films that we'd seen, and we would reenact them in our basement or our garage or the doghouse or wherever we were, or make puppets out of them and, you know, pull out the television, and in the old days when the television was recessed into the wall and split levels, and do them there. So
wait. So you did go to plays and you went to movies. How young are we talking here?
I I really remember my parents went to drive-in movies. I'm sure thinking we would be asleep, but I was always awake. And, you know, they'd throw us in our feety pajamas in the back of the station wagon and take us to drive-in movies. So I remember seeing them very early. And, you know, I'm of an age where it was really, you know, in terms of television, we had a black and white television, but it was quite an event still. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm old enough that it's, that... that it was something that people kind of gathered around in the evening sometimes. So I do always remember that being a part of my life. And storytelling, my parents were both teachers, and so they read us books. I read very early, and or would, you know, sit on my parents' lap while they were reading, you know, either newspapers or books. And so storytelling, I guess.
Right. So there's storytelling all over your childhood.
There
right?
was in
right.
my childhood.
There's imagination, there's play, there's right. experimentation, there's all that stuff, right?
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
So when do you have some memory of when it began to coalesce into this is something I want to do or be?
Well, I, you know, a little different from Jim because he came to it later in life. I never remember wanting to do anything other than producer act ever in my whole life. I loved writing as well, but I always thought of it as an offshoot of that. Even the PR business that I had for a while, I always thought of it as kind of an extended form of telling the story, but I never remember wanting to do anything else.
But act?
But act and produce. My mother
produce.
Told
this is fascinating. Tell me about that.
So my mother tells this story, which I don't even really remember, but she was, you know, I grew up in suburbia in the Midwest, and my mother was having a group of bridge ladies over, and they were complaining because I was taking all of their children's money. And I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. I wasn't very old. And they said that I was doing shows and charging admission and taking their children's allowance. And so my mother came to me and said, are you, you know, charging money for kids to see shows that you're doing? And I said, yes. And she said, where's the money? And I said, under my bed. And she said, well, what are you going to do with it? And I said, we'll take everyone to the circus. And so she got the money, and I'm sure there was not enough to take everyone to the circus, but my mother felt obliged, and we took everyone to the circus. And I thought it was fantastic punishment and kept doing it. So I...
Well, talk about reinforcement.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That was so smart of your mother.
Yeah.
If she knew that she was, what she was doing. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So yes, you were. You were actually producing at a very young age. Producing your own shows. You were doing what you're doing now, for
yeah.
God's sake.
It's funny because I was shy as a kid, but I would be bossy about those things. You know, I would just organize the kids and, you know, you're Little Miss Muffet and you're whomever. And I was kind of always sort of directing people about and doing that. And I'm not a director. It really kind of came from the impulse, I think, to produce or act more than to direct.
Do you have siblings?
I do.
And where are you in the birth order?
I'm the oldest.
Of course. Yes, right, of course. It's the perfect position.
Is that common?
For the right. Well, it is common. It's not inevitable,
uh-huh.
But it is common,
yeah.
Yes.
And are you?
I am. It takes one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So this urge to create stuff and produce it and give it away, you know, have other people experience it,
right.
Is there from the beginning, right? And so did you do this in elementary school? Did you, mm-hmm. you know, how did that go?
I did. You know, it was the way I played with all the neighbor kids, so it was a part of my after-school life. But in grade school, you know, I mean, it was everything from, you know, being a book in the library play to...
Being a book in the library play? Is
yes.
that what you said?
Yes, I was a talking book in the library play, too. You know, to you know, types of pageants and things that you do.
So you when they were there to be done, you were there to be doing them.
And even, you know, at some point I was making them up if they weren't doing them. We did a, we, I read some Little Nell type melodrama, and we did it after school, and I just produced it after school. Or
what, after school? How old are you here?
This would have been in grade school, fifth or sixth grade, and I just produced some Little Nell type melodrama script after school.
Are you saying that you wrote it?
No, it was some Little Nell existing script, a kind of melodrama
right.
that I read somewhere and just decided that we were going to do it. And
so you said, all right, everybody, like that?
Yeah, pretty much. And then in junior high school, it was the era of dinner theater, and I thought our junior high should have a dinner theater. So I went to like the local Pepperidge Farm bread people, and I kind of got all these donations, and we made a dinner, and we named, you know, Kool-Aid drinks after our, you know, vice principal or whatever, you know, because I thought that was a part of the, you know, what you were supposed to do with dinner theater. You're supposed to have funny names for the drinks. And so we did some Neil Simon piece then, and then we did something in the lunchroom. We decided we would do plays over lunch in the lunchroom, and because the lunchroom was where the stage was, and right. you know, it's usually in the gymnasium
right.
and the cafeteria, they're all the same thing. And we did it over lunch, and we
okay,
just did them.
We,
you know, friends, just
so you had other friends who also wanted to do this.
Yes, I think so.
Either that or you made them.
Yeah, yeah. They were different groups of friends. Sometimes, you know, as happens, you just, you know, you as you go into different ages, you have different friends. But it was always with others, definitely. It wasn't a
It was always a collaboration.
Thing. Yes.
You were never a solo performer.
Nope, never. Never.
No. Okay, good. Yeah. So at some point, you decide that you're going to study this in school.
I did.
And I'm curious. Do your parents have an opinion about this?
Well, my father was a teacher and a football coach, and then later became a college administrator. And my mother was a teacher too. But she had, I'm sure the interest, my interest was piqued by photos of my mother in, you know, doing Kaufman and Hart and doing...
Oh, she was an actor.
In college. She was interested in college. But there were photos of her in Shakespeare. And so I think we asked my mother about these photos that we found in a drawer. And, you know, I'm sure she inspired the interest in us.
So she never said, and I wish I had done more of that, or I really liked it, or
she didn't at
any
that,
of that
time, but... I suspect that there was a longing inside of her. She had had an offer to go to a Juilliard and to as a singer.
Oh.
And she sang and played piano, and I think it was perhaps a road not taken for her.
Yes.
And she never said that until maybe later in life.
Yeah, but you know that stuff gets communicated.
It does. I think so. I definitely think I probably felt it as a longing in
yes.
my mother, or an unfulfilled longing. And so
yes.
I'm sure that is part of the inspiration.
And her response to you doing it was what?
My mother was very supportive always, and, you know, she sewed costumes but she was not someone who was pushy in any way. And because I was shy outside of the realm of theater, I had a stutter until I was in college and was meek, I think. You know, I'm the oldest of these four children, but I had a sister 11 months younger who was kind of probably more the take charge child.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think she felt it would be my vocation, but she didn't discourage it, nor was she pushy in any way or thinking this was what I was going to be. But they drove me. I did shows in the park, you know, as a young kid. I worked backstage at a place called the Barn Players in Kansas City in the Jewish Community Center, and you know, did variety shows wherever I could, and they would always drive me, so they were always supportive, and you know, but not I would say more supportive than neutral, but it wasn't any kind of push, you know, nor any kind of discouragement, really.
So you were really Well, it's interesting, because it's not, it seems to me, pure in the sense that there was no, you know, you were just sort of allowed to discover yourself and find yourself. I think there was this other sort of underlying thing, you know, with your mother. So
yeah,
right. Okay, good.
I suspect that.
Yeah, and I think that's probably right. Yeah. So then when you are getting ready to go to college, mm-hmm. and you say you want to split major.
Well, my father had always had a rule that my father had grown up poor and had, you know, worked nights while he was going to college, and so his rule was that his kids had to pay for their own college education and their own weddings, and he wanted us to be self-sufficient. So I went to a community college for a year after high school and then went to University of Kansas, and and I did know early on that I probably would have preferred to go to a conservatory or program, but I was a little meek and shy, and so it was not, the idea of going to University of Kansas was not, it was not very far away from home, it was 45 minutes away, but they ended up having a fantastic theater program, and then eventually I went to ACT in San Francisco.
Okay, but wait, so when you say you're going to major in theater, your parents say, okay, fine?
They did. They didn't, you know, I was a double major in theater and journalism because I think that impulse, again, to tell stories was part of it for me. So I liked to write. And I got a work study in the journalism department. So I think that's why I became journalism as opposed to English or
something else.
Or playwriting. But, and the person who was the head of the PR department, you know, mentored me in some ways there. So I think that's why it went that particular direction. And, but I was a major, but I was not a great student. I mean, I'd been a straight A student in, you know, junior high and in grade school, but I was not I was impatient. I wanted to do it rather than
learn it.
Yes, and I loved my theater classes, but I was not really dedicated to getting to the other classes, mm-hmm. or, you know, I'd go and take the tests and, you know, muddle through, but I think I was always, I sort of turned it into a conservatory, whether it was or not.
For you?
Yeah, and what I spent time in was in rehearsals and in doing the shows at the college, being in them or crewing them or stage managing, and then taking classes about them. And that's pretty much where I lived, and mm-hmm. then got a chance to go to ACT then and left.
And so then you went to ACT and...
And that was a revelation. I will say in some odd ways, the University of Kansas program was very disciplined and really great and provided a better foundation than I might have gotten if I had just gone to ACT. Mm-hmm. But at ACT, the big revelation for me was Bill Ball's philosophy. Having been this meek child, the idea of being bold or brave in the work came from him, and probably from his madness, truly, for those that know him. But it was, you know, in his directing book, he talks a lot about, say, yes three times. And I was probably, it's the idea, you probably know this, but about how we edit ourselves. So an actor may come into a rehearsal room with some idea, and they may say, I'm going to wear a bowl of fruit on my head, and you just say yes no matter what. And then they say, I'm going to, you know, then they do it, and then the next time they say, I'm going to have a bowl of fruit on my head, but it's all bananas. And then it's, you know, I mean, but they keep, it keeps growing, the idea keeps growing to some logical extension until there is some deeper reason that is revealed. And through the course of going as far as you can go with some crazy idea, you either get it out of your system and know that's not it, but you don't spend the rest of the days wondering if I'd only done that, or it's the brilliant extension of some idea and it's deep and meaningful. And so he was very much somebody who would drive the students to create the strongest objectives they could possibly find. You know, he always talked about the verbs being active, and the work was never passive for him. And being somebody who was kind of a toe dipper in life, he forced us to make bold and brave choices that sometimes failed, and and he failed and it didn't hurt and it was okay. So that
you survived it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Oh, that's great. It's great. It was the right choice for you.
Yeah.
Because it was what you needed.
Yeah, it right. was. And in fact, you know, here we are years later and Jim and I co-founded Rubicon Theater Company. And the whole idea of crossing the Rubicon mm-hmm. is moving forward with tenacity and commitment and going
and
forward.
And courage.
Yes, and there's no going back.
There's no going back.
Once you cross the Rubicon, that's
well, once you get in it,
yeah,
you better cross it.
Yeah, exactly. So I always think that it has been a life journey for me. And although I hope it hasn't culminated in the sense of being, you know, done here, I think it was, it definitely came.
No, it's in the you're doing it.
Yeah.
You haven't done it,
yeah.
but you're doing it.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So you get out of SCT, and what happens?
I came to Los Angeles. I was trying to decide whether to go to L.A. or New York, and because ACT was on the West Coast, I probably had more friends that were in L.A., although I was always a theater baby. But I came to L.A. and got into some shows right away, you know, you develop friendships and networks and mm-hmm. Began to work. I worked a lot at La Mirada, Civic Light Opera in those days. I worked, there was a company that was in the Hollywood American Legion building that did a lot of work and got to work with them for quite a bit. I did a Philip Berry play there and, you know, it was an ongoing company, so I had friends, and then they drag you into other things, and you're taking classes. And I was on a short-lived television series called Against the Grain, which was a lot of fun. And then right after that, got hired by a company that's now defunct that was in Santa Barbara, a regional repertory theater, and met Jim, and then my life sort of shifted to the Central Coast.
Okay, so when did you start being an administrator or doing all that?
Well, while in Los Angeles, really. Although, again, you know, in high school and college, I was always on both sides. You know, I was always kind of working on both sides. I liked to organize it as well as do it. But when in L.A., the PR side sort of kicked in first. I was taking classes from Michael Shurtleff, and I traded him my acting classes for doing PR for shows that he was doing. So I learned seat of the pants, really, how to do PR for theater mm-hmm. in L.A.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. And then, so ended up doing that. And then I had a PR business called State of the Arts. And after I was up here working for the repertory company I mentioned, they had a publicist who had was on some medication and couldn't really recall if they'd, you know, followed up on things.
Oh,
so they took a medical leave. And I was in a bunch of shows in this regional summer program, but they needed a publicist to jump in right away. So I would be rehearsing by day and early night, and then late night would write the press releases every week. Jim had to stay up with me because he was the associate producer, and so he was up all night with me half the summer, and we were engaged by the end of summer. But the but so that PR business kind of grew there, and then friends with whom I'd worked started to say, "Oh, I'm doing this show in London. Will you do PR for me, or will you do?" Or I, by doing some PR out here, I met a New York producer who said, "Oh, I need some help on a show in New York." So I got to have a pretty broad PR business after some time, and then I was often doing PR for regional theater companies, and their fundraising person would, there was always a lot of turnover in fundraising, or they'd be missing their marketing person, or they'd be, you know, somehow
that's right.
I ended up being kind of
everybody
fill-in person.
Right.
I had this business, and it became a kind of broader consulting business that went into group sales, strategic planning, marketing, fundraising, and, you know, it's kind of just what happened. And I was always hiring actors, and so we were spelling each other, you do this opening night, and you do this one, oh, you can't do that when you're in a play, or, you know. Mm-hmm. So then my business grew, and
you were the perfect employer.
I had some wonderful people work with me. I mean, I had, you know, I did it for 15 years, and I think the average time anybody was with me was 8 years, so I had a lot of, you know, they were great, because they you know, I think when you let people do what it is they love, they're very loyal.
Of course.
They make fantastic employees.
So. Okay, all right. So then, then what happened?
Well, I was doing that, and I was working for Ensemble Theater and PCP Theater Fest and Norman Kurtz in New York, and I had all these clients. Jim and I got married. I was also acting during this time period, and because the other people in my company would spell me when
yes,
I was
right,
in shows
right.
too. So continued to act and build clients, and then that business sort of ended when I came to Ventura to work for the Ventura, it was then the Ventura Chamber Music Festival. Mm-hmm. The city had done a big public planning process, had wanted to redefine the city as a cultural arts destination, but we didn't have venues here in Ventura at the time. So the idea of chamber music in historic sites with themed receptions was the kind of big idea at the time. And my firm was hired to take it from being a city-run event to building a board of directors and making it a...
Self-contained.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I did that while Jim was out on tour with Jesus Christ Superstar. He was playing Pontius Pilate in the national tour. And they thought it was going to be a pretty short tour. It ended up being a very long tour. And while he was out on tour, I took that job. And I intended for it to be just a client of my company, but it became pretty all-consuming. It was 22 events in a short amount of time, and I loved it. And I more than even loving that, because it's not that chamber music is my passion, I loved this community. There was something about the people here probably that felt like home to me a little bit. I think the people in Ventura are very like Midwesterners. It's an agricultural community, so that may be part of it. I come from ag roots, but they're people who have great follow-through. They're very committed. They're very open and just dear. And so I came to love this place. And so I didn't, so after working at the Ventura Chamber Music Festival for a year or two, I gradually began to drop my other clients, and it became about Ventura. There's a longer story too, which probably isn't as interesting, but there were, you know, I'd lived in Santa Barbara and had this kind of easy life, really, I would say, in the consulting world, because I wasn't working in the nonprofit world. I was telling nonprofits what to do, which is much easier. I did it backwards. I should have, you know, probably worked in one first for real, but there were these two incredible women working in the Ventura government, Elena Brokaw, who was a Harvard grad, and Sonia Tower, who was this great arts administrator, and they were courting me to try and get me to come do this job with the Ventura Chamber Music Festival. And Sonia was one of those people who kind of, you know, bores into you. She kind of looks you in the eye and is a little kind of prophetic, you know,
right.
She'll say, I know you, and you have to be some place where you're seeing the light bulb go off above people's heads, and you're just done in your other work on Santa Barbara. It's all too easy now. You need to help make it happen, and she was right, you know. So this was a place that was wanting to develop culturally, and so I got to be here and have
and
to
help,
see the light bulb
help
go
them
on.
Do it right.
Yeah.
That's great. It's
yeah.
great, and it's right back to the early producing thing. I mean, you
yes.
know, it was waiting for you,
yeah.
right? It was waiting for
yeah.
you.
Yeah,
and inside, it was waiting for you to find it again.
Yes, and I think the idea of doing it, you know, warts and all, versus telling someone else how to do it and
yes.
having that safety.
The distance,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, the distance.
You were
safety.
In it now.
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe that was a step on that risk-taking journey,
yes,
too.
Yes, all the same
the
stuff. Right,
yeah.
Right. Okay, so then clearly you're here in Ventura,
yeah.
and Jim described a little bit for him, the idea that at least he came to this place where he could look back at a career And then looking forward, thinking, you know, this is a real struggle. I don't know that I want to continue to do this. And so did you have a similar experience with it, or?
I think certainly similar. I think we joke sometimes that if we had started this when we were any younger, we wouldn't have known what to do. If we started it when we were any older, we wouldn't have had the energy, right? Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it's full of life lessons all the time. And sometimes those lessons are about your own limitations and sometimes about the limitations of the form or the model or the or doing it in a small town, not because there aren't people that are hugely supportive, but that there are a finite number of them,
right,
you know, in a small town. So it's definitely, has not been without challenges and moments of, you know, wondering if we're crazy.
Are you crazy? Right.
Yeah, and those, the moments where it seems impossible or like there's something that is insurmountable and that, and there's always that moment of, well, is this, you know, the moment that I give up, or am I going to overcome this hurdle, and how will I, and with what divine, you know, help will that happen? And, but as those happen more and more, you realize why sometimes theaters don't make it. It is too dependent on those moments. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very ephemeral. It's a very ephemeral business, and you know.
So you can never say we've made it, because you never know, right?
No. Yeah, I had this interesting talk with Gordon Davidson once, and said, you know, was one of those "what's your proudest achievement" kind of questions, and his was just
surviving.
Surviving the longevity, and
right.
I don't think I understood that then. I thought he was going to say, well, this show that went to Broadway, or this show that, you know, has been produced all over the world, but I do understand that now, just to be standing, you know, after the recession, and to still have a passion for telling those stories, to not have that sort of the stuff knocked out of you, you know, when you stop feeling that, I know you'd have to stop, because it's not an automated, you know.
Oh yes, no, you can't just go on. No, you know, you can't go on automatic pilot here.
Mm-mm.
But it's interesting. It does seem that for you, life has always been about this in one way or another. Either telling the story or helping someone else tell the story,
mm-hmm,
or helping someone else tell their story.
Yeah.
You know. And so I wonder if that ever, I mean, with something that's so integral, if that ever is over. I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't think it will be. I don't see an end to it for me. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to see continued growth in it, an extension of it, and some, you know, hopefully some increase in my ability to do it at a higher level. I hope all those things will happen, but I don't think there's another path for me. I don't.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, because I said what I said, but I didn't mean to suggest there was not another path, because what you've described so far,
uh-huh,
is a variety of different paths all going in the same,
uh-huh,
you know. So there might be a different path.
I think the path is just theater. I mean, that's,
well, it's the essence of, right.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't mean, there can be a number of paths that do that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And my guess is that,
yeah,
when you took that first PR job, you didn't know that was a path.
Right, no.
And when you were doing that full time as Madam, you know, top of the heap here, that you didn't know you had a theater in your future.
Yeah.
So,
right,
you know, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I guess it's the broader path to me, the broader path of the theater, the storytelling.
Yeah.
That's the...
It underpins pretty much everything.
Yeah,
right.
For me.
Do you want to talk about the shows that...
Yeah.
Yeah, please. Because we have Jim talking about this list,
uh-huh.
but we have more.
We do.
So please do that.
So after we had put together our season for the coming year, we had some, through a series of wonderful partnerships, some other productions become possible that we've recently announced. And we're very excited about them. And they're very diverse, which is part of our, you know, mission and commitment here is to have extremely, you know, wide range of shows. So one is written by a New York playwright named Carrie Cram. It's called 23 and a half hours.
He talked about
it. Oh, he did. Good.
He did talk about it, yeah.
So that's, we did it in our Plays in Progress program, and I think it's as strong as any Pulitzer winner of the last decade. It's, I'm so excited to premiere it here, and Scott Schwartz is going to be directing it, and he's phenomenal. So that's one. Also, Little Miss Scrooge, did he show that with
yeah,
you?
He did.
Okay,
he
good.
Did, so he did.
So
yes.
Maybe
right.
The only one he might have missed is Romeo and Michelle's. Did he tell you about this one?
No, I don't think he did.
So that's the newest. So Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion, which of course was a fantastic and fun, crazy film that made had lots of great cast members: Lisa Kudrow and Mira Sorvino and Jeanine Garofalo and Alan Cumming. And anyway, so the original producer of that, Barry Kemp, came to us and with a fantastic team assembled. Peter Schneider is involved with it too, and Lawrence Mark. And the director is Kristen Henge, who did Rock of Ages on Broadway.
Wow.
And the musical team is the young kind of indie phenoms that are the songwriting team for Weeds and Orange is the New Black. And so we're going to get to premiere it here.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Okay,
yeah,
and I will.
A kick.
Yeah. All right, I just realized there was something I wanted to ask you that I forgot before I asked you to do this, and that was you said, I'm not going to get it quite right, that you wanted to do more. It wasn't more. Higher, better? No?
Probably, I mean, certainly you did.
But what, do you remember what you meant?
You know, we're in this precious, sacred space here.
Yeah.
I feel about this building. It's really intimate. There's a connection, a very palpable connection between the artists and the audience members here. And, I suppose what we all want to do really is tell stories that are transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we've done that a lot in this space because of that connection. But I think that there are also limitations that come from, either limited resources, whether that's time or, physical resources.
Yeah, space.
Yeah, space. So I would love to, you just want to be able to do it at the highest possible level.
Yeah.
You want to be able to.
You want to be able to do your vision.
Yeah, you want
and
to be able to.
And you can't do your vision here because you haven't got.
Sure.
Right.
And
right,
you,
I got
and,
it.
You know, you want to be able to say yes three times to any director's great idea.
Yeah.
And for them to be able to say yes three times to any actor's
brilliant idea,
brilliant idea. So I'd love to be the place of yes always in terms of expression of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so. So that's great. And then, there are those simple things on a business level we've gotten to move some things on, and that's very gratifying only because they find a larger audience to hear them than to receive them. So Jim probably told you, but we were thrilled, one of the shows we got to premiere here with David Zippel won the New York Drama Desk Award.
No, he didn't.
so we did. We had David Zippel created and directed a piece that was a Cy Coleman review called The Best Is Yet to Come, the music of Cy Coleman. We got to do that in New York and got to win a Drama Desk for that. And we've had a show called Daddy Long Legs that we did with John Caird and Paul Gordon, whom we adore. And that show has now played 15 cities in the U.S. and 5 countries and is having a life. And we're this Little Miss Scrooge, which he did talk to you about,
mm-hmm.
is with John Caird and Paul Gordon again, and then John's son, Sam Caird, who's quite a Dickens expert. And it's a great fun kind of pop rock Dickens mashup that I believe should become a holiday classic. So we'll hopefully send that out into the universe. So I think that idea of being a place where a nurturing environment where things can
you're a launch pad.
Begin and grow and then have a, you know, like children have a great successful life without us, you know.
It's a lovely, it's really lovely, you know. I mean, it's, if more people were trying to do stuff like this, we would have a better life, you know. I mean, really. Okay, so the other question I ask is, having given a life, and you apparently have given a life, to this whole idea of making stories available to people in one way or another, is there anything you would say about that, about what that was like or what you think about it or anything?
Well, it's a blessed life that, you know, going back to Sonia, you know, saying you'd like to see the light bulb go off. I do. I think that, you know, the joy of seeing, whether it's young people in our education outreach programs or interns or playwrights discover their own voice, or, you know, there is you know, such joy in living a life where you get to see people make discoveries, you know, in themselves and each other. And that's, I don't know, I find that really gratifying.
That's a great place to stop.
So
thank you so much, Carolyn.
Sure. Carolyn describes what her path is about in very much the same terms that I describe what my path is about, and that is helping people discover themselves and one another. Our ways of doing it may be a little different, but the desire to demonstrate that we human beings are perhaps more than we thought we were. And Carolyn and her husband Jim dedicated to presenting stories that help us to see what it means to be human. And by writing those stories, acting in those stories, directing those stories, producing those stories, making those stories available to audiences, being an audience for such a story, we are all continually, I want to say confronted, but I don't mean it in a bad way. Confront has such a pejorative sense to it. We have in front of us what it means to be human, the many, many ways it means to be human. And so we have an opportunity to ask ourselves, am I the complete human that I am? and I haven't said in this show, but a concept that I believe that most of us are living out what I call our cover story. That is, this is the story that we either came to believe was true of us, or was told we were, or decided it was the only safe thing to be. And so that is what we convinced ourselves we were. And that is what we tell other people we are. I don't know how many times in therapy I hear people saying, well, that's just who I am. And most of the time, that simply isn't the truth. That is part of who you are. It's just not the whole truth. It's a version. Cover story. You understand that that's what spies use, so as not to expose their real selves because it would be dangerous. And I think it's the same thing for us, that we create a cover story early in our life, because to expose some part of ourselves would be we'd be embarrassed or humiliated or teased or punished or, well, you know. And this can happen in our childhood, in our family of origin. It can happen in our school. It can happen in our religion, our culture can let us know what is good and what is bad and what is right and what is wrong. And if we happen to be some of those things that our culture or our family or our religion or our school tells us is not right, then we begin immediately to deny that. Over and over again, I say to clients, you are who you are. Not because people are often saying, but I don't want to be this, and I don't want to do that, and I don't want to think this, and I don't want to have this. We are who we are. We can only begin to alter after we have accepted. And in order to accept, we have to know. And that's what discovery is all about. Knowing. Being willing to be human. To be who you are. Often, people will say to me, I'm so judgmental. Oh yeah, I really want to stop being so judgmental of other people. And I have to tell them that you can't give another person what you don't give yourself. If you're judgmental of other people, critical, unkind, then I know you are of you too. So, discovery can only happen when you are willing to be who you are. Okay, fine, so you don't like everything. Okay, fine, so there are some things you wish weren't true. Well, that's part of being human. We're all a little petty, we're all a little selfish, we're all a little jealous, we're all a little frightened, we're all a little insecure. These are human qualities. It's okay. It's denying them, pretending you're not them, that makes them have to come out in some other way. Admitting to being who you are, seeing who you are, embracing who you are, it takes the pressure off. And so, as I say over and over again every week, that The Lynn Show is about discovering who you really are and getting access to it, the good, the bad, the ugly, so that it doesn't have to come out in some destructive way to you and or others. And here we have Carolyn Burns and Jim O'Neill showing us over and over and over again the very many ways in which one can be human. And if she didn't say it, and Jim didn't say it, and I didn't say it, I want to tell you that the very first show of the season at the Rubicon is the Sunset Limited, and it begins on October 23rd and runs through November 17th. And you can get more information about the Rubicon Theater at, I'm going to give you the number and I'm going to give you the email address. The telephone number is, in Ventura County, 805-667-2900. And the email address is rubicontheater.org. And if you didn't write that down fast enough, or you've lost it, you can go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and I'll tell you what it is. Okay. As always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that caused you to ask if there is a discovery of self hiding inside of you. Or something that made you laugh, or something that made you think, well, you know, something that'll make you come back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days, well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some guy.